Welcome to the Public Morality. An opponent is someone that you battle in a competitive environment where there are an agreed upon set of rules that both sides adhere, along with mutual understanding to abide by the outcome. An enemy threatens your survival, where the rules of engagement become subjective, whereby the ends justify the means. With each election, America lurches closer to the latter consideration. Our pursuit of the amorphous, more perfect union is stalled by an enemy that looks like us, because it is us. How much longer can this grand experiment sustain itself while the inhabitants view each other as existential threats? Joining me to discuss America's political division is University of Arizona political science professor Chris Weber. Professor Chris Weber, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
It is popular to offer politically that America is a divided nation. What, from your perspective, does that mean?
Well, a few things. It's a great question. So one is the country is more polarized than it's been. At least through the 20th century. And what that means is the political parties have moving further and further apart ideologically. And this is particularly true among political elites. So say members of Congress, there's very little like ideological overlap or heterogeneity within both parties. And so what that generally means in practice is say, the most liberal member of the Republican Party is still considerably more conservative than the most conservative member of the Democratic Party. And so in many ways, it's sort of no wonder that the parties rarely reach common ideological ground. I'd say that's the first thing. There are several other trends that are actually quite disconcerting and are relatively sort of recent in American politics. One is known as sorting. And so what's happened is that voters have actually moved or gravitated into both political parties along a number of important dimensions. One, again, is ideology. And so, again, we just don't see the kind of ideological consensus that used to emerge in politics. And this is due in part to two political parties that have formed, you know, relatively homogenous ideological camps.
This seems like such a long time ago now, but during the 1996 acceptance speech during the Republican National Convention, nominee Bob Dole said of former President Bill Clinton, "He's my opponent, not my enemy." That seems like light years ago. What has changed in 28 years?
Yeah, that's also a great question. So rhetoric has changed pretty remarkably over the last 30, 40 years. There's been an erosion in civility, the way political candidates speak and particularly talk about their opponents has definitely moved in an uncivil, quite offensive direction. And again, it's sort of no wonder that people have become so entrenched in their partisan beliefs when we look to political elites and these are the kind of behaviors we observe. It's sort of no wonder that partisan hostility that is has reached such high levels.
Now, I could be wrong about this, but I believe beginning with the presidency of Bill Clinton, some segment of the opposition party has compared the incumbent president, whoever that may be, to Adolf Hitler. Besides any historical inaccuracies, explain why such comparisons are problematic and sort of, and in some sense, perhaps undermine American democracy.
Yeah, you know, it's again, we've kind of seen both the erosion of democratic principles and support for democratic principles alongside this kind of erosion of civility. And when you attack or vilify an opponent in this way, again, it's really hard to then subsequently try and find common ground and work across the aisle. It's unproductive speech in a sense. It's generally quite counterproductive. While these references are increasingly common, I don't think that they do much to sort of cultivate understanding and tolerance and just this kind of important American principle of putting up with ideas that maybe you don't like, but putting up with them. I think what we're seeing is, again, a decline in that sort of tolerance.
Well, I'm certainly not a political scientist, but if you tell me what I support is aligned with Adolf Hitler, it seems to be a non-starter for any kind of further negotiations to find some kind of common ground. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, no, I think that's entirely correct. And there are certainly more productive ways to address what really has turned into greater public support for anti-democratic principles. I think these things can be pointed out in other ways, other than sort of invoking Adolf Hitler and other authoritarian leaders.
Does money play a role in our divisive culture? And what I mean specifically is, I could see one being motivated to give to a certain candidate as much to stop the other side as actual support for the candidate. So, wouldn't that further enhance the partisan animosity that we're experiencing?
This what you're touching on here is also a very important and sort of disconcerting trend in American politics. And it's the rise of kind of two things that are related, and they're known as negative partisanship and affective polarization. And so what's again sort of tended to ha or what has happened over the last 20 or so years is that support for one's own party, so general like enthusiasm for one's own party, has stayed pretty constant. So a Democrat, say, rating the Democratic Party, or a Republican rating the Republican Party, it's generally stayed static. What's changed is the orientation towards the out party, where what we tend to see is that partisans, again, aren't necessarily more enthusiastic about their own team. They're more hostile towards the opposing team. That's known as affective polarization, and it's actually really not only common but problematic for a simple reason, and that is it's that politics seems to be driven by what people don't like rather than necessarily what they prefer. And we see this also with an increase in what's known as negative partisanship, or generally supporting a party, not because you support that party so much, but because you view the opposing party as threatening with respect to ideology or policy positions or rhetoric. And
So,
so, yeah.
no, go ahead, finish. Sorry.
And so again, when we sort of think about things like campaign donations, and even political activism in general, I think we need to ask ourselves, is this driven by necessarily support for one's own politician or a fear of the opponent?
So, let's just say that I am the prototype for the negative partisanship. And so I give money and I do everything because I need to stop you and what you represent. So my candidate wins. What's the downside once an election has been achieved? What's the downside to democracy? Am I least less likely to hold my candidate accountable even though they may do something that I oppose because I so am opposed to the other side? I mean, how does this affect democracies? Well, I guess what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think there's greater acceptance for, let's say, policy slippage, that is, supporting a candidate that doesn't necessarily represent your own views or your own values, and then not necessarily holding that candidate to account. Let's say they win office, not holding them to account for the things that they do in office, because again, It's not that the vote is based on a kind of running tally of what your preferred candidate has done, but again, it's this fixation on the opposition and the threat that that opposition poses.
Throughout the American narrative, there's always been division. We've always, going back from Jefferson and Adams, I mean, there's always been division. How does this the present moment differ in your view?
Yeah, it's a, again, I think a really important question because that is absolutely correct. Division, debate, disagreement has very much been a part of the American experience. And there's certainly periods in American history where division is quite great. There's periods where it's sort of lessens and is calm, but there's always been division. I think what's, again, really changed in kind of the current moment is many of these things that I've sort of mentioned, kind of the changing nature of what it means to be a partisan today, that is a Democrat or Republican, dissatisfaction with the two major parties. It's my understanding there's not a whole lot of enthusiasm or excitement about a Trump Biden rematch in the electorate. And this is particularly true among young people. And so in a sense, I worry that we're kind of ignoring the things that make democracy function, that is advocating our own positions and presenting our own positions in a palatable, tolerant light that is civil. And that has just generally kind of eroded over the last 20 or so years. And that's actually quite different. In the mid 20th century, the political parties really weren't as divided as they are today. Again, there was quite a bit of ideological overlap where we saw, far more conservatives in the Democratic Party, liberals in the Republican Party, and just a whole lot of people in the center. The center sort of dropped out now, and what we have is two parties that are in many ways ideologically distant or separated, again, kind of like undermining this idea that it's just very hard to ever reach common ground. And that, coupled with the increase in civility, the uncivil rhetoric, particularly with the rise of Donald Trump in 2016, again, that gives me a good amount of worry for, again, these exact reasons.
Well, how would you respond to someone who may say to you that they listen to this broadcast and then they say, "Come on, Professor Weber. I mean, this is not like 1860 when shots were fired at Fort Sumter. I mean, 1861 when shots were fired at Fort Sumter. This began the Civil War. Is this really that big of a deal?" How would you respond to that person?
That's correct. There are definitely differences, relative to hundreds of years ago, for sure, and even relative to 50 years ago. That said, we're really in uncharted territory here. Again, just empirically speaking, the country is more divided than at really most points of American history. We've got these again. Kind of disconcerting trends, which I've highlighted, the erosion of kind of tolerance and incivility, and an increase in both violent and anti-democratic rhetoric. Now, what that leads to, I don't know. I'm really not sure. I can't predict these things, but it does seem to be progressively getting worse, and also more serious. And so, I guess I wouldn't downplay it, and I wouldn't downplay the severity, but I entirely understand that times are different and times change.
Is this, in your view, also a function of the larger culture? This seems, in my view at least, increasingly binary in its overall application. So wouldn't it stand the reason that politics would just, follow in that sort of binary vortex?
Maybe could you elaborate a bit? I'm not.
Sure. I mean, so much either okay, the best I can for example, I know a lot of people that watch the women's basketball championships. A lot of people like Caitlin Clark, a lot of people didn't like her. So I mean it's just there's no nuance. There's no sort of everything's binary. There's no nuance to the equation. And so that seems to be our culture. It's this or it's this. And so it seems to me, doesn't politics organically follow the culture? It's this or it's this. I mean, who's the candidate clamoring for nuance, for example?
I don't know if there is a candidate clamoring for nuance. I do think that having two parties, again, is very much sort of fits with this idea of a binary culture. Again, what I would say that's different, though, is the kind of centrality of politics. I often say this to my students. They're quite a bit younger than me, and all they've really known is politics in the polarized era, where everyone talks about it. Being a Democrat or Republican is very much central to one's identity, much more so than, say, in the 70s or 80s or early 90s. And so I guess what I would say is that the choice is binary, but what has changed is that so much of life, social life in the United States has become politicized. The teams you support, the sports you support, the music you listen to, the products you buy. It seems like there's a political aspect to nearly everything now. And again, that's really unique. Politics, at least through much of the latter half of the 20th century, was of course important and in influential, but it kind of like would rise and fall with elections. That is the identity itself. It's not clear to me that partisanship and the kind of strong, salient partisanship that we observe today applied, say, in the 1980s. And I think, in a sense, that's what makes things also different, is just the just general politicization of life.
I'm just curious, as you mentioned your students, I don't know if you've polled them or asked them, but how do they define democracy? Or do they even see democracy as a valued tool the way my generation may have saw it?
This is definitely something that's coming up in the news, that it seems like there is greater support in the American public for anti-democratic solutions. I'd say I don't generally, or I don't tend to observe this in my classes. I don't know if it's because, I'm dealing with political science majors primarily, who, are trained and learn quite a bit about not only American democracies, but democracies across the world and how they function. So I really haven't personally observed this kind of preference for anti-democratic solutions or democratic backsliding, which we certainly see, at least in polling data, in the American population. But yeah, again, I haven't really witnessed that per se.
Now, if you allow me to put my cynical hat on for just a moment, as if the previous portion of the conversation had not been cynical, is what we're calling political division a tool for the ambitious politician to really drive their base closer, feeding on a politics of anger? So, I mean, isn't some of this an actual political tool to win elections?
Yeah, it is a vicious cycle. That's exactly right. It's that it what happens is that these are trends that have occurred, this polarization and all of these kind of polarization type trends, like sorting and negative partisanship and affective polarization. And so yeah, so these are all trends that are occurring. And certainly politicians exploit these things and magnify these things. We also see changes in technology and society that have happened over the past 20 or so years, which really exacerbate these trends. So one is the nature of the mass media today, the fact that we can choose our news. It might be dubious kind of information. We can create our own echo chambers where our beliefs are again kind of like rarely challenged, and we just sort of move in a way where we're constantly reinforcing the beliefs that we already hold. And in these kind of information spaces, politicians and sources come up that again kind of reinforce or further cue these tendencies. And so what happens is a vicious cycle where the public becomes more extreme, politicians play on the extremism, and the parties continue to move further and further apart.
It seems to me, based on your last answer, that what's really required, I don't know if we are ready to do collectively, which is to examine ourselves. I mean, again, when was the last time someone lost a primary for being too divisive?
Yeah, I think the idea here, and there is an importance in this, that the various ways that society has changed. And so again, if we sort of think about information technology and like the role of social media and just how we get information, there's just less cross-cutting discussion. We don't, again, we sort of collectively speaking, tend not to sort of reach across the aisle or have like bipartisan discussions like we used to. And part of it again is the way we get information and who we surround ourselves with, say on social media platforms. Cross-cutting discussion in American democracy has always been really important. It turns out that, people who interact with those who hold kind of competing or different views tend to be unsurprisingly less hostile towards those views. But when we're sort of in this system or this state where that kind of discussion just rarely happens, again, we rarely kind of see this kind of, I guess, collective tolerance.
Well, to amplify your last answer, I was recently in a conversation with a gentleman who was angry with President Biden because, these are his words, that Easter fell on the day that Biden called for Trans Visibility Day. And I was trying to explain to him, well, Biden didn't do that. Here's how it worked. And his response was, obviously, you're a Biden supporter, so there's no point in me talking to you. And so I guess that seems to be what we're up against. If I just have a counter narrative to someone's existing thought, I must be part of the enemy. There's no way to reconcile just an error in facts.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's exactly what's I think problematic about contemporary political speech is that kind of interaction seems to be increasingly common. And it's not just that, you were called a Biden supporter. It was that it's like, let's just shut down now because you're a Biden supporter, rather than sort of acknowledging it. Maybe trying to understand it, or at least putting up with it, and kind of listening to that perspective. And that very much kind of defines the divisive nature of contemporary political discourse, and that again, we don't see the kind of same degree of tolerance, maybe, or acceptance that was, more common in a less divided country.
So, to that extent, is there a correlation between the health of American democracy and the candidates and elected officials that continue to question the legitimacy of the 2020 election? I mean, here we are, the previous election is nearly 4 years in the rearview mirror, and we're still questioning its results. So, is there a correlation between the health of American democracy and our inability to accept the recent results is legitimate for some, not all, for some.
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of broader and maybe more general though. And so what we've seen is a general erosion in trust and confidence in not just governing institutions, but a number of other American institutions. So what I mean by this is there's less trust in Congress. There's less trust in the Supreme Court. There's less trust in the president. There's less trust in media. In news media in particular, trust in even things like higher education and the education system in general is eroding. American democracy isn't just a series of institutions. It requires a commitment of its people to sort of view the government as and these again many institutions that are sort of adjacent to government. As credible, as legitimate, as again, kind of just generally supported. And we don't see this. And so challenging elections and challenging election institutions is certainly part of this, but it signals, I think, much of a sort of a broader trend in that there is a serious erosion in democratic values, support for democratic institutions. And this is, in many ways, an existential challenge to American democracy as we know it.
Talk in your view, why does this political divisiveness resonate with so many?
So a couple things. I do quite a bit of work on a construct in political psychology. It's got quite a long story, interesting history dating back to interwar Germany, and it's known as authoritarianism. I don't study authoritarianism from the perspective of institutions or leaders, governing regimes. I study authoritarianism in a much different way in that in democracies, there is usually a subset, actually in any society, there's usually a subset of individuals who are inclined to readily defer to authority, submit to authority, endorse their values. And what we've seen with respect to authoritarianism over the last 30 or so years, that is people who generally prefer conformity over, say, personal autonomy, is particularly in the white electorate, white authoritarians have slowly gravitated to the Republican Party. 30, 40 years ago, there are about as many authoritarians in the Democratic Party as there were in the Republican Party. But with the rise of many of these kind of normative issues, these normative threats, that is like threats to social order and stability and traditional values, the Republican Party is in many ways shifted and made an appeal to issues and values that are really quite important among authoritarian voters. And it's really like the divide that we see is like these authoritarians have moved slowly but quite steadily, and it certainly escalated during the Trump administration. They've moved to the Republican Party. And with that has come a certain degree of divisiveness that we really haven't seen. Authoritarians tend to be more inclined to say, oppose democratic principles, oppose democratic institutions. And so with this kind of sorting that I've generally talked about, we also see this authoritarian sorting that's occurred. And that too is very much kind of eroding support for democratic ideas.
Well, with that, let's sort of move this discussion to some of the potential elephants in the room. Each time there have been groups that have expanded the understanding of America's civic virtue of liberty and equality, there's always pushback. Whether it's women fighting for women's suffrage or the abolition of slavery, LGBT equality. There's always some pushback. So I'm wondering, is the pushback, given your last answer, is it because there's a group that that has oversimplified or have an over-reliance on a simplified understanding of American history, and any change is a threat to their understanding of American democracy?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call it simplified. Just again, out of in the spirit of kind of maintaining productive, tolerant speech. But I would say that there is certainly a group in society who are more attentive to changes to the sort of traditional way of doing things, and challenges to the traditional order that is might lead to all sorts of, say, exclusionary policies. So I guess I would say that the issue is more kind of tradition, the way things are, and with tradition, comes particular sets of policies. When those traditions are challenged, there is a subset of Americans who respond with more anger and with more fear than say others. And in my line of work, one of those groups are authoritarian voters.
I mean, so would it not be fair then to conclude that the vision that we're talking about now, and while you and I are having this conversation, is really something that's several decades, if not longer, in the making?
Yeah, that's an important point. Nothing that I think we're experiencing today, we can't entirely attribute these things to one presidential candidate or president. These are trends that are 20, 30 years in the making. They've occurred slowly over time in fits and starts, in a sense that not all elections and say folks running for presidency stoke these fears. And so, we see like candidates like John McCain, for instance. He really wasn't and didn't stoke these kind of culture war kind of divisive policy threats. The same happens to be true of Mitt Romney. And so it's not as if we've observed this kind of steady state movement towards the world we're in now. But to attribute, the current state of things to one person or one movement is misguided. These are trends that are many years in the making, and due to particular actions, again, in both political parties that have moved the parties apart.
I want to talk about a phenomenon that, at least in my view, is tied to this anger, and that to stoke the anger, there has been a certain degree of othering. In this case, it's been largely, I'm not attempt to be partisan here, but it's been largely Republican Party. And what I'm specifically referring to is that there's been an othering to have reproductive rights outside the mainstream. The 1619 Project and critical race theory sort of misappropriated to so they can be presented outside the mainstream, making voting more challenging to certain groups are somehow cheating in the process outside the mainstream. Concerns about transgender equality. So it seems to be the only group that has been immune from this type of othering has been white males. So is it the vision that began the conversation more complicated than is projected in our public discourse?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct as well. And so when we again think through the kind of policies that are central in politics now and are really divisive, they tend to be these cultural issues that are very much a challenge to traditional authority and traditional power. And so I think it's spot on to say that the group that's been immune to this has been primarily white males. And again, I think very much part of the reason we have these divisions and the reason why authoritarianism, say, as a political construct is so important politically now is because These issues resonate really strongly with authoritarian voters, which make up a non-trivial share of the American electorate. By no means a majority, but a large enough share that, say, in Republican primaries, which tend to be far more extreme and appeal to a much more ideologically extreme group, and the same applies in Democratic primaries as well. They appeal to a more ideologically extreme base. We hear again, kind of, this othering that is really common in these primaries, and in many ways resonates with this kind of core block of voters who are generally opposed or resistant to progressive policies that increase diversification, and just general diversity within American society.
I wonder then, from your perspective, is some of that human inability to maintain with the culture? For example, the 1776 understanding of democracy was not the 1865 understanding, which was not the 1965 understanding. So, in some respects, one can conclude the present moment, in spite of its discomfort, is really just part of a democratic process that's always, in some regard, playing catch up.
Yeah, democracy certainly evolves, and representative democracy, as we understand it, evolves, or you could say Republican democracy evolves. It changes, but again, what's really important is, sort of despite the changes, there really needs to be support for the institutions that fuel democracy, particularly those institutions that are supposed to be above partisan politics. So, things like the news media or the Supreme Court. And what we see again is a decline in general support and trust in these institutions, which again is problematic for many of the reasons we've discussed.
I just saw a recent PBS poll, and it revealed the findings that when the question was posed, if violence was an option to get the country back on track, overall, 79% of the people disagreed with that. But when you dig a little deeper, 12% of Democrats, 28% of Republicans, and 18% of those defined as independent felt violence may be an option to get the country back on track. Given your last answer, while it's not a majority that feels this way, what does that say that even, because as far as I can see, those numbers should be zero, but that's just me.
And this is a trend. I don't know if I'm going to entirely answer the question, but this is a trend that is actually also fairly common. When you ask, about sort of explicit abandonment of democratic principles, in a general sense, what you tend to see is there's opposition to it. But when you start to like dig in a little further and ask, under this circumstance, would it be okay? There seems to be, far more support. Again, I don't know. I don't know, given sort of the lack of these kind of questions in previous surveys, whether this is unique or not, but it's certainly disconcerting. Because again, that's not the democratic solution, obviously, to resolving disputes. Quite the contrary. Instead, we rely on institutions to resolve disputes, whether that's social or political or otherwise.
I'm wondering, because democratic rule, however defined, is the most challenging because the democracy is only as strong as the people within the system. Are we at a precipice, in your view, where the challenges that face us may be greater than democracy's ability to confront them? How do you see that?
So as pessimistic as I may have kind of come off, I'm not, in a sense that I don't think we've reached the point of no return by any means. Again, I think it's important to remember, and you pointed this out earlier, that American history is replete with examples of violence and opposition to social change. And in many ways, it's sort of like the story of social movements and social change. The type of issues that the country is confronting now are incredibly serious, and we don't seem to be moving in a positive, beneficial direction. I think we're generally moving in the other way, which is democratic backsliding, erosion, heightened intolerance, viewing politics as almost a team sport where the opposition is the mortal enemy. And while that's all incredibly disconcerting and certainly keeps me up, I do think that there are solutions. There are places where I think we can find common ground. And I do think that much of this does hinge on the kind of leaders that we elect and the kind of politicians that we get behind, and what kind of speech are they using? How do they talk about politics? How do they talk about the opposition? How do they treat kind of cross-cutting issues, that is, issues they don't agree with? Do they strive for bipartisanship or some sort of agreement, or do they dig in and move further to the ideological extreme? I don't think we're at a point where, again, we can't return to an era of kind of greater support and endorsement of democratic values. There are things, though, that are working against that sort of movement. Again, I think a large a share of the blame can be applied to folks who are in positions of power and authority, the folks that we elect. Another area which makes this kind of change to a more, or pivot to a more democratic, tolerant, and inclusive society is the nature of social media and how we collect information. Insofar that we can simply just surround ourselves with information that never challenges our beliefs, and with friend groups who tend to hold our similar values and beliefs, and that we're never really pushed to think about things from a different perspective, that makes the kind of tolerance and productive change all the harder to kind of reach and accomplish. That said, again, I don't think we're at a point where we can't return to a more tolerant, accepting, and inclusive society.
You mentioned outside groups and outside influencers, and I want to touch on one, my own industry, what do you want to call it, journalism, mass media communications, how you want to define it. But the fact is, you stated earlier that this conversation, what's affecting this conversation, is not a majority of the electorate. But at the same time, if you look at the people that are on your cable news outlets and giving commentary, are not necessarily the people that are in Congress, for example, that are making legislation. So I guess what I'm asking you is that it doesn't take a large swath to really disrupt democracy the way our current system is configured.
That's totally correct. That is 100% accurate. That what we are talking about here, particularly, with the question about violence or support for violence and just support for anti-democratic principles, this is not a majority held opinion, or these are not majority held opinions. But at the same time, we need to also remember that a big part of American democracy, and particularly voting, is participation. And not everyone votes, as you know. We just don't practice universal voting in any stretch of the term in American democracy. And so, even though the folks who maybe support these kind of anti-democratic agendas make up proportionally speaking, a relatively small share of the population, they can have an outsized role in democratic politics based on how American elections are structured. And so we have primary systems which very much appeal to a kind of base partisan, ideologically extreme voter. And again, that's on both sides of the aisle. The folks who participate in a primary election, on average, look nothing like the folks who participate in a general election. And so what we end up with in American elections more often than not are ideologically extreme candidates who may not represent the large swath of voters who reside in the political center. I mean, in the state of Arizona, when we look at party registration, when you sort of look at third parties plus non-declared independents are the largest voting bloc in the state. And so we often hear, at least in Arizona politics, about how things, on occasion have been really extreme. But, even in a state like this, we should acknowledge that it's not a state where we have extreme ideologues sort of fighting for a particular agenda. Rather, most of the voters are in the middle, but it's those voters in the middle who are also less inclined to participate. It makes sense because, again, if the choices are generally extreme and maybe less than palatable, folks stay home. And so, long-winded answer to the question is, these groups do, these kind of anti-democratic ideas are not a large share of the public, but when again we think about who votes and who participates, proportionally speaking, they are a reasonably large share of active voters.
I'm asking you, my next question is based on you being a political scientist and not partisan, but I think it does tie to some of the divisive nature that we're experiencing. If you took away the Electoral College, which is a quirk in democracies around the world that we have that, take away the Electoral College, the Republican Party would not have won an election since 1988. It would be complete Democratic dominance. And with that said, could you not also make a tie to that, to the Republican Party being the party that really wants to corral who actually votes? So at the core of some of this political divisiveness is really cynicism to win elections. Did I just oversimplify it?
I don't think you oversimplified it, and I think that the statement is certainly correct that politics would certainly be different if the Electoral College were eliminated. And it is an institution that currently benefits the Republican Party. But we should ask why it benefits the Republican Party, and again, kind of where it came from. I often ask my students to sort of think about what politics would look like in general, not just contemporary politics, but what would the nature of, say, campaigns look like if the Electoral College were eliminated? And and as I'm sure you and your listeners know, it would look quite different. We would have campaigns that would focus on larger states. You would see candidates be more likely to visit large metropolitan areas and big cities as opposed to smaller states with disproportionately fewer voters. So it's an institution that tends to benefit and was developed and created to ensure representation of smaller, less populous, often rural states. In the current state of politics, those states tend to support, on average, Republican candidates. That's not always been the case. So, as a modern institution, it certainly is the case. But I do think it's important to ask, given the geographic size of the United States and the diversity of the United States, what would politics look like in the absence of this institution. I think you're absolutely right that the institution would certainly change the complexion of politics, but it would change sort of the nature and then the perception of like sort of who is being represented. Smaller states would play a much less important role than they do now.
Professor Chris Weber, University of Arizona. Sir, I want to thank you so much for a most enlightening conversation. Thank you for joining me on the Public Morale today. It's been much appreciated, sir.
Thank you so much for having me, Byron.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can also listen on an app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.